Today on the AF Podcast, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of the classic movie Boomerang, one of the best black movies of the 90s. I'm joined by Andrew Mombo of ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast and Headley, past contributor to South Shore Ave, as we discuss our favorite scenes and moments, Robin versus Holly, breaking guy codes, the obvious star power of the cast, and a lot more. To listen to more podcast shows, make sure you subscribe right here to SouthShoreAv.com. Once again, that's SouthShoreAv.com. Also, just to put a little disclaimer out, this may be the podcast that, you know, you want to put the children to bed first before you pop this one on, or at least cover their ears due to some of the adult content. It's the AF Podcast with Cal C on South Shore Ave Radio. Bang, 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 bang.
Welcome to the AF Podcast with Cal C on South Shore Ave Radio.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the Boomerang edition of the AF Podcast. I'd like to welcome my next set of guests. First guest is a past contributor to South Shore Ave and has been on quite a few episodes. And a few years ago, he helped me co-write the New York Undercover Anniversary blog podcast. Blog post. Please welcome Heather to the show. What's good?
What's good?
And my next guest is making his second appearance on my podcast. He was last on the 25th anniversary of Juice, and he's also the producer of the newly released 30 for 30 podcast shows on ESPN Radio. You can locate each new episode on iTunes and the ESPN app. And also by August 15th, he's also my fantasy football nemesis. Please welcome back Andrew Mambo to the show. What's good?
Thank you, man. What's good, bro? We're friends for another month, man.
Yeah, it's not too much longer. We got about 5 weeks left before I start PMing you with a bunch of shit talking and all that stuff, all that good stuff.
Another but 6 months of hate, 6 months of love, bro.
All right, so we're here to talk about the 25th anniversary of Boomerang, a movie directed by Reginald Hudlin and produced by Eddie Murphy himself. Honestly, this is one of the great black movies of the 90s, to me anyway, which as well had one of the best-selling soundtracks of all time, which was put up by LaFace Records, which is Babyface and L.A. Reid. Now, before I begin, what was your first impressions when you think of Boomerang? I'll start off with you, Headley.
I thought it was just dope, the concept, to tell you the truth. Just the fact that you got these ultra-successful, ultra-fly women, men, you know, doing it in corporate America. I just thought the concept, and then obviously, you know, womanizer and all this stuff, and basically getting the wool pulled over his eyes. It was a different type of movie, but just with the teaser, it kind of won me over. I was like, yeah, I want to see this.
And what was your impressions, Mambo?
I had a huge crush on Halle Berry, and Robin Gibbons. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I was young at the time, right? So I think, like, rewatching it more recently, you start to see some of the ridiculous womanizing, kind of some of the sexist parts of it. But when you're young, you just watch it and you're like, this is hilarious. Eddie Murphy's funny. Martin Lawrence has got jokes, you know. Mm-hmm. David Alan Grier, his dad is hilarious. It was great. And it was great to see, like, you know, you're seeing people that look like you on screen. You know, you're seeing black people successful, just like Headley said. And that was just motivating. It was a beautiful thing to see, because it was something at that time, it's something you just did not see, people who look like you who are successful in that way.
Yeah, at least not enough material for it anyway.
Yeah.
Outside of like the Cosby Show, we can't really talk about the Cosby Show, can we, at this point? No.
The Cosby Show is, you know, I mean, it is what it is. You can't take it out of the historical context of what it represented and what it meant to black America in the 80s and 90s, man. It's, you know, I mean, present circumstances.
I know, it gets a little sticky and sketchy. Yeah.
Yeah, but it is what it is, and at the time, it resonated the way it did at that time.
Mm. Well, my impressions of this movie, honestly, is just, I'll start off with this. It's the star power of this movie. You know, you had Eddie Murphy, Robin Givens, Martin Lawrence, David Alan Grier, Halle Berry, Chris Rock, you know, Lila Rashan, Tisa Campbell, Eartha Kitt, Grace Jones. Like, it's a crazy list of stars.
Yeah, but, I mean, you look back at it now, some of these guys was before their big heyday. Like, look at it now and see what they became. You know what I mean? Yeah, you're like, wow, this was star-studded, but back then.
Yeah, but back then, at least, it's not like they were just a bunch of no-name actors getting up on, you know what I mean? Like, some of them might have been, but some of them already had a name.
Halle Berry at that point, Halle Berry known for? Halle Berry was best known for playing in Jungle Fever. She was Gator's girlfriend in a crack house. I mean, that was like her best known role.
And Halle Berry wasn't Halle Berry now.
And losing Isaiah.
Martin Lawrence wasn't what Martin Lawrence now. Like, I mean, these guys was at the beginning of their career. It's great looking back, but I mean, these guys. I mean, Eddie Murphy, yeah, was a name. Some of those guys were names, but I mean, maybe half the cast was.
If you take out Eddie Murphy, Grace Jones, and Eartha Kitt, everybody else was rather like up and coming. They were just starting out. I mean, losing Isaiah was after this, man. This is really one of like Halle's first couple of movies, I think. And
I say, look back at it now, you're like, whoa, man, this cast did stuff. Like, yo, it's crazy because this is where Martin Lawrence and Tisha Campbell met each other.
That's not true at all. So
this is where the creation of Martin, where he basically, if you want to call it Pooch, I don't know if she read for the script or not, but basically was like, hey, I think we should continue working together.
Maybe that part, but the first time they met, I don't think so, because I don't know. I remember a movie called House Party.
No, okay, I take that back. Maybe not first time they met, but in terms of. Because I even heard it afterwards, doing the research of this, that this is where it became the idea of, like, you know what, we should continue working together. I'm working on this script. Is Martin and be like, you should play my girlfriend on the part, based on how the chemistry or how everybody was working on this movie. That's what I meant to say. I think it's not that for the first time, but like, you know, basically, like, this was like the infancy of a lot of these guys' careers, where later in life, you know, you'd be like, you know, these guys are still working actors 25 years later, kind of thing.
Right.
Interesting, because they never had a scene together, you know? Like, I wonder how they're...
I know, that's what I found was weird, too, when I read about that. I was like, yeah, because they really didn't work together unless this was just commodity, like...
I mean, they had scenes together in House Party, but we won't talk about House Party anymore, I guess.
Why are you being a...
They also had scenes in House Party 2, I think. House Party 2 also was before this.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, they definitely worked together at some point, but I won't dispute the fact that the idea of her being on, you know, her being Gina, you know, from Martin was it might have been hatching on this during this time. It's all good. But like,
was she in Do the Right Thing too? I'm trying to remember.
I can't remember if she was in Do the Right Thing. She might have been Samuel Jackson's girlfriend in the movie. I can't remember.
I know she was in School Days. I mean, she did, like, you know, back then, man, you wonder, like, I mean, how many
stuff was the number there, to of, be like, honest?
How much crossover, like, how much, like, crossover were people, like, you go back and you look at the casting of so many, like, black films from the late 80s, early 90s, and there's so much crossover.
It's
like,
the same movie.
Everybody was in the same movie constantly.
Right.
It's like 1 degree of separation for every black film between 1985 and, like, 1998.
but I think the biggest thing for this movie at first was obviously this was Eddie Murphy's big comeback. Well, one of his big comebacks, probably his first big comeback, because obviously, you know, he had Saturday Night Live and Trading Places and all that stuff, but then his career kind of cooled off. I think the lowest point at that point prior to Boomerang was, I believe, another 48 Hours, you know, where that movie tanked hard and everything else. And then he directed Harlem Nights. That didn't do that great in theaters. So this movie was like a big comeback for him, you know. And then Robin Givens, it was a comeback for her as well, because, you know, especially after the whole Tyson divorce, her name was being dragged through the mud. as basically like a gold digger that nobody liked. And this movie kind of gave her back some light.
Basically a gold digger?
She
was a gold digger. Come on, dude. Like, there's no basic in that. let's call a spade a spade now.
Oh, man. Robin Givens.
Being very literal here. And then you had Martin. His career was taken off at a point, too, because remember, he was the host of Def Comedy Jam at that point. So in the black community, his star was rising, you know. And then, you know, he was on the House Party movies and everything else. David Alan Grier, obviously, he was in Living Color. There was some people doing their thing. And then, of course, we got in. Well, for many of us, I didn't see, you know, I don't remember her so much in Jungle Fever. Not Do the Right Thing, but Jungle Fever. But Halle Berry, that was like my first real introduction to Halle Berry. And it was, like I said, you look back at this list, Chris Rock was getting his start, like, from this movie with New Jack City before that. But this is another, like, I'm on moment for him, too. And he played a great role. Grace Jones did a great job in this movie, too. Like, you look at the star power of this. It's just, as you said, looking back then, it was everything melted together so well.
Yeah. You realize, like, all this star power, it's really interesting to see, like, the place where all of these guys kind of started, because the 90s, that everybody is in that cast, the 90s ends up becoming like their decade for so many of them. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, Martin Lawrence owned the 90s, man. In our sphere of entertainment, rather, I'll say, I guess not everybody was watching Def Comedy Jam and watching all of his movies or watching Black Knight and everything like that. But it was
interesting. I mean, are you serious, Marvel? I'll put that as a category success. I would throw in quicker. Yeah, Def Comedy Jam, Martin.
I wanted to see if you caught that. That's like Bad Boys. Bad Boys is like Bad Boys would definitely be a word, man.
Don't forget, Calvin. I think you might have been with it. Remember the time when we went to go see his comedy show, Martin Lawrence stand-up?
Yeah, I think so. Had? I think so, yeah.
No, that ish was hilarious, son. Hilarious.
But you know what? To make it a throwback moment right now, you used to get those the VHS tapes sent in from your sister and your brother, I think, with the Def Comedy Jam tapes outside of House Party. That was the first time I really caught Martin and like in his wheelhouse.
To put it straight, so my sister lives in Pickering, still lives in Pickering, but Pickering was basically like New York City compared to Montreal in terms of what we could get for black content. So she used to get, so basically I think it was on UPN where you had Martin, and then you had, what was that one with Queen Latifah? Living Single.
Yeah, that was on Fox.
Oh, yeah.
It was a Fox. Mm-hmm. So basically Martin and Living Single, it used to come on back to back. So she used to just put that, the VHS, you know, when you break off that little piece and you get that 6 hours on SLP, and you should just
you snap the tab
that back to back.
You snap the tab off?
Ship it. Huh?
That's it, you snap the tab off after you're done?
Yes. Yeah, snap it off so you don't record over it.
You don't record over it, man.
She used to tape those back to back for us and just bring it down. And yeah, that was like, we used to just feast on that, you know. That was like getting fresh biscuits or something, man. If you just come over and be just like, just feed on that.
I remember a friend, same kind of scenario, but one of my friends, her older brother used to go down to New York all the time because they had family there. And he'd always come back with new tapes of Def Comedy Jam, and it was, you know, Saturday night, that was the joint, man. Happy to go over, everybody's going to watch that, everybody's going to sit back watching Def Comedy Jam. Yep. That was the first time I remember seeing Chris Tucker, and you see Chris Tucker, and you're like, when you think back at Def Comedy Jam, some of the people that came out of that is also another, like, but now we're digressing a bit.
Yeah, I know.
Is Def Comedy Jam still even on, is it?
No.
You said digressing, like, I thought, like, it was still out there.
I'm saying, like, we're making a digression from Boomerang, like, we're getting away from the main topic, but, like,
yeah,
like, Def Comedy Jam was, like, another platform that started off so many people, and when you look back on it and you see, you know, who came out of that is amazing as well.
Yeah, true.
They actually, this is like funny aside, they did try to relaunch Def Comedy Jam recently, didn't they?
I know they did something. Well, actually, no, I'm thinking Def Poetry Jam. They had that, but that was like 10-15 years ago, I believe. But I can't remember if they started back then.
Anything with Def Comedy Jam got to be at least 10 years now, man.
Yeah. I feel like if they did, it was probably like around like the early to mid-2000s if they did that.
Yeah, I was going to say something around the mid-2000s, maybe.
But
yeah.
But it couldn't have been the same. It's hard to capture lightning in a bottle, you know what I mean? Because Martin at those times was like, that was the dude on that. Like, he kind of made that. You know, that platform. So it's hard to kind of recapture all that. It's like somebody else now coming out with their version of the Chappelle Show. It's not the same.
Yeah. Don't forget Kid Capri.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what was your, out of like, I'm not going to include like Eddie Murphy and like Robin Gibbons and Halle Berry and stuff. Between Eartha Kitt, Grace Jones, and John Witherspoon, who was your favorite small role actor in this movie?
I was saying, I think John Witherspoon stole it, man. I mean, that whole scene when he comes over to the house and they have that dinner and with David Alan Grier's mom and dad, that scene is just absolutely brilliant, man. I mean, me and my friends used to crack jokes on that scene and, you know, replay it again and again. It was just from the mushroom coordinator. You got to coordinate, like the belt, the inside of his jacket, the scene when, like, he's at the table. Mark, I hear you got some You got to reverse it. And the whole bang, bang. I mean, he just like took that entire scene from when he first walks in the door to when he leaves. The whole thing is like owned by John Witherspoon.
And it's
so for me, that was my guy.
And it's his only appearance in the movie too. But like, you're right. It's not even the fact that he stole the show. I think he made a whole career basically off of that. Because he basically plays the same role all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that was the most popular one. Because remember, he was a next door neighbor at House Party, you know, trying to call the police, you know, and he was in a little role for that, which is funny, but it was nothing compared to this. And after this, I felt like after that, it snowballed. But between this and Friday, he can play that role for life, basically, and nobody minds.
Oh, yeah. Everybody loved it. He was absolutely brilliant.
No, for sure. What about you, Henry? The same?
Nah, Eartha Kitt, yo. That scene where she's basically seducing Eddie Murphy, and Eddie Murphy, he gives it, and to this day, dude, it doesn't matter how many times I watch the scene, when they turn off the light and it's pitch dark.
can you make it a little darker? Like,
I laugh every single time I see that scene. You know, the best in
that is like when he first gets there, and like Eartha Kitt's there, she welcomes him into the house, and her assistant is like walking out the door, and as he's closing the door, he just starts laughing. Like, and you see that, and then later on, the same thing when they're bringing the food at dinner, he's bringing the food, he's putting the plate on the table. Looks over at Eddie Murphy and starts laughing, and then walks out the room. And Eddie Murphy's face is like, "What the hell is going on here?"
And then afterwards, when Eddie finds out that she's just the figurehead, and then she comes into the scene and she's like, "I'm not wearing any panties." Oh, yo, I felt the shivers if not my spine for you.
You know what's funny? Watching this movie again, that part kind of resonated with me because, like, just putting myself in his shoes when the butler's laughing or snickering, like, just putting myself in his shoes, that plays mental mind games with you right there, man. Just that the fact that him laughing would have made me find an excuse to leave.
Oh, man, he wanted the job.
He wanted that promo, man.
But you know,
he wanted that promotion, bro.
but you know what though? It brings up another point too. You know, in the game of life, and when you're single and you're doing your thing, sometimes you take losses, man. And even though you could be the biggest player, you know, you got a couple of skeletons in the closet, and I mean, trust me, and everybody, and we all got them, and you did it for much less. They're for a job promotion. Yeah, you know it.
Yeah, exactly.
All you listeners, you know it.
especially your listeners. Yeah, we know them.
Well, here's the question I'll ask, Mambo. What's your skeleton that you can carry to share without naming names?
Are you serious?
Keep it moving. Keep it moving.
It's just Costco. It's just for a reason. Don't even bring that nonsense to me.
Next question. Next question.
What the hell is that?
Jesus.
This don't really make it sound like we just talking on conference on phone. Like this shouldn't get be recorded.
It's a podcast, man. I'm trying to keep it relaxed.
Nah, man, it ain't that relaxed. Why don't you talk about your skeletons?
I can definitely talk about it. It will get edited out though. But I'll definitely talk about it if you want to be talking about it.
this jackass will be like, "Hey, I'll go first," and then like you go, and then he'll just conveniently edit his out.
I still remember about how you try to, you know, you try to talk about Dave Chappelle me with about what happened at Carabana that time, and went and made that elaborate lie.
Wow!
And then I wasn't even able to rebuttal that. Put that at the end of one of your segments.
That's a hand to God moment. I don't know what you're talking about.
Let's continue. Because we know how you like to be in the editing room. You like to create stories with your editing.
Yeah, whatever. Robin versus Holly. And before I get into the comparison, watching this movie, looking at both these, you know, both these beautiful women and this woman that we all of us pretty much idolized probably after this movie, at least for a little while, if not for until this day with Holly Berry, of course. Here's the concept I'll ask, because obviously one was playing the good girl, the other one was playing like the dime piece in Robin Givens. So I'll ask you guys this question. The question I'm asking is the concept of getting a dime, of trying to get with somebody who's a 10 as opposed to somebody who's like a rated as like an 8 or a 9, for example. Is it worth copying the dime or try to wife a dime? Is the concept of that overrated when you look at the long scheme of things?
If you talk about Robin Givens being the dime, obviously she had a lot of baggage with her where it's not worth the hassle or the headache.
And mind you, sorry, I'm not talking real life. Obviously, I'm talking the movie. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends. I mean, with a kid to Robin, if you're just having a good time, it was all cool, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to get serious with her, obviously she had her own issues, just like anybody. I mean, you know, was trying to play the field. She wasn't trying to be that life. She wasn't trying to fill that role. As opposed to Halle Berry, she's like the one that kind of creeps up on you. And it's funny because watching Halle, even though obviously this is really occurred, playing like the second fiddle, it's so weird because that's so not Halle. I mean, you would take her in a minute over anybody nowadays, right? So it's just funny seeing her in a role like that because you're like, she's not second choice. She's not, if Robin is supposed to be steak, she's not Chitlins. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
She's on the same course, like the main course dish, in my opinion. But I guess, you know, take the whole Halle out of it. Just talk about, you know, going for somebody who may be lower in the stakes in terms of looks. But because of her personality and all that stuff, I mean, to me, that makes it qualify as a dime. Because a lot of the stuff, like Robin, who you look at the tops of the worlds today, where they look—I mean, they look fabulous—but their whole mentality and makeup of their mind is just mush. You wouldn't want to deal with that. You wouldn't really call that a 10 if you spoke with them for like 2 minutes or see what they're really about, right?
Mm-hmm. I'll say it like this though: I was like a teenage boy when this movie came out, so for me, honestly, because Robin Givens spent the most time in lingerie in this film, I was definitely Team Robin. But in hindsight, looking back, I think Halle Berry is the one that you should be going for. She's definitely a dime. She's definitely like, I was, you know, but your kid's boy, you're just taking over, you're like, that one's half naked. Like, that's obviously the better choice. You know, Halle Berry stays clothed the whole entire film. Like, but the film, there was really no contest. Unfortunately, it was not the most sophisticated mindset at that time.
No, I mean, and you're right, but I don't know, it's just something I kind of thought of just watching the movie a little bit, just because, or just at least it makes me think back of those days, you know, when you're single and you're going after that person who's like physically is like a 10, but when you're dealing with them and, you know, when you're dating them and all that stuff, it's they become more stressed than it's worth, as opposed
to something. Exactly. Yeah, but that's just natural. And like when you date somebody, you don't know exactly who they are when you first date them, and then you get to know them, and you're like, oh no, I'm out. But you know, I mean, I wouldn't say that that's like the movie's not set up. It's a movie, right? So it's not. It doesn't really exactly mirror the way reality would work necessarily.
And look, I mean, we're still men. It's not like we're gonna go after a five just because she had got great personality. Like, let's be real.
No, obviously
she's
not.
Still,
but
she's still gonna have to look great. She's still gonna, as you said, she's gotta be, as you said, be an eight with personality, and that's fine. If you're gonna be like a five with personality, that's not cutting it.
And as married men, I think we all know we all married dimes. So. You know, any of our wives in
the they got the whole package. Everything I say is excluded any of our wives, let's put it that way.
Exactly.
let's just put that. This is that note out there right from Jeff.
You made me nervous when you said eight. I just wanted to get that in there. We weren't talking about, like,
I'm back to the day, Bravo. Thank you for making that clarification. I'm talking about
I got you back, bro.
Yeah, thank you. I don't need no hate mail, and
she is a better room. You're gonna get hate mail from your wife.
No, but there's other wives out there that probably would. What are you talking about? Is that what you're trying to say?
But I'll say this much though. Honestly, this version of Halle Berry is my favorite version though, man. For me, she was just. And I know, Heather, we've discussed this like offline many times in the past. She's probably one of the few people that I swear the short hair look is just made for them.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like it's her.
Yep.
It's Nia Long, and I'm forgetting somebody else, but
Elise Neal, dude. Elise Neal.
Oh yeah, Elise Neal. Oh yeah, I forgot about her too.
Yeah, man.
But they have a look where it's like they can pull off different hairstyles and they'll always look good. But something when they have the short hair. It's just, it's a killer. And for her, like, back in the day when she, you know, with the short hair, it was a wrap. Like, it made her beautiful, but also you felt like she was attainable even though you knew she wasn't.
You know what's so ironic? Halle Berry played the girl next door, cute, great personality, everything that you want to check off in life in terms of being your woman. But in real life, that woman... It's probably not somebody you want to date. Listen to the stories that you hear and the breakup that she's managed to go through. Hey, I'm not trying to blame her all the time. But when it happens so many times in a row, what? You got to look at yourself in the mirror and wonder, is it me?
So eventually she became overrated.
Well, I think it's still like, I don't know I don't know, overrated sounds like the wrong word there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I still have a chance to be with them in my single days, I would still do it.
Yeah, I don't think that's long. I don't think you know what,
this is the most scared podcast I think I've ever had in my life. go on.
No, Henry, I just want to say, Henry, that I really appreciate you letting us know that. Everybody who's listening know that you would still give Halle Berry a chance if you're back in your single days, because I think that's a burning question we've all been wondering, whether you would have like rejected Halle Berry or not. Of course, like that was really an option. Swordfish Halle Berry, for the record, Swordfish Halle Berry is my favorite.
Oh yeah, yes,
yeah.
Especially when she came out of that bathing suit.
Yeah,
oh jeez.
I'll give you a quick story that I watched that movie with our mutual friend Aileen, and when that scene came on, I made her give me a high five.
Yeah, man. How much did it pay her to do that again?
$500,000.
That seems like good money.
No, was it 500? I think it was a $500,000 bonus, or was it $1 million bonus?
I felt like there was six zeros behind that digit.
Yeah, I think it was $1 million bonus. It was 500 per. Died another day though.
James Bond. Don't forget that James Bond. See that with Billy Bob wasn't bad either.
Yeah. Something always felt wrong about that though.
I know. As I said, I was like, I still take the Swordfish, but I tell you the truth, I've never watched a whole movie in my life, huh?
Just that one scene?
That one scene. No, I watched Swordfish. I'm talking the one with Billy Bob Thornton.
Oh, Monsters Ball?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've never watched the whole movie.
And I want to touch on Robin Givens, the role that she played, the great role that she played, you know, being sexy and dominant, independent, and she was the mirror image of Marcus. And it just shows how powerful that she was, just mentally and just even physically, just the way that she just rocked Marcus to his knees. I thought that was like, you know, it was like she was basically the representation of karma for Marcus.
The two scenes of her that where I was like, they actually did it great was the first scene where she kind of was like, yo, you know, this is just for fun. Are you getting kind of caught up? He's like, no. What do you try to? He tried to play it off. And he was like, yo, so when I'm going to see you again? And she's like, let me check my schedule. And then got the secretary to call and said, like, oh, I got Wednesday open. And then this dude flipped, like, Wednesday of next week. And he's like, I'll take it. I was like, yeah, dude. Power just went up.
What about the scene? I think it's before that one, but she comes over off after her trip, and he's all mad at her, and he still sleeps with her.
I know.
And then she leaves because she's like, "Oh, I got meetings. I gotta get up early. I gotta go." And leaves some cash in the bed and leaves $200 on the side table.
Boy, that was afterwards. Yeah. Because the $200 was for the tickets, but just seeing it at the side of the coffee table like that, it was like, yeah, it really looked like it was for paid services. Hey. Shout out to Toronto.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even realize Toronto was mentioned in that movie until I saw it again. I was like, oh shoot, the business meeting was in Toronto. The reason why she was late and all that stuff.
That's right.
Oh yeah.
Listen. I was like, okay then. Toronto was getting love back in '92. This was pre Raptors. Who would have thought?
Right.
Just before the Raptors, right? So maybe they paid him.
No, it was
advertising for the Raptors.
This is way before the Raptors. So whoever put that line in there, thinking that Mambo was a goddamn genius, I'll tell you that right now.
Exactly.
All right, so let me ask another question as a scene in this movie. Did Marcus break guy code when he got with Angela?
Bobby, you want me to take this, or you can take this?
I mean, I think so. He broke guy code. He broke guy code because he didn't actually know the extent to which David Alan Grier's relationship was with her, right?
Right.
So by all accounts, he might have thought, like, as far as he knew, David Alan Grier and her had hooked up and they'd been together or had something, and maybe it failed or maybe it didn't or whatever. He had no idea where they stood. So, like, yeah, he broke guy code in that sense. He didn't break guy code in the sense that nothing actually did happen, and they were just friends. So it's like, but I guess, you know, the fact that he didn't have that information, and the information he was working off of when he hooks up with her was that, as far as he knew, they were together. Yeah, he totally broke guy code. Oh, that's not cool.
Unquivocally, he broke guy code. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. Because, as Mama was saying, going on the situation and just going for what he knew his boy was into her. At the very least, even if anything, if nothing had happened, he knew he was into her, and he was trying to broker the deal. You saw the scene where they're all working out and they're talking about like, yo, have you smashed it? So you know he's working on it.
Mm-hmm.
So for you to go there and then just the slickness that he tried to ask after, he's like, yeah, so what's going on with you and Angela? So I guess you don't mind if she dates other dudes. Dating other dudes and dating your best friend is two different things.
Mm-hmm.
My ex can date whoever she wants. She can't date and think it's going to be cool. My boy's going to be cool to be like, oh, yeah, can I date your ex kind of thing. You know what I mean? So he definitely broke guy code. There's no way coming around that.
At that point, when he's actually asking him that question, what's up with you and Edra, he's already struggling with her.
Yeah, that's
what I'm saying. What the is the question? The question's bullshit.
Exactly. That doesn't make you feel better. That doesn't make the situation any better.
Hey, so what's going on? Hey, by the way, yeah. Like, and what if he's like, yeah, yeah, we're together. It's like super serious. I'm about to ask him to marry me. Oh, shit, really? Okay, well, crazy story. After the party the other day, so, we're doing the dishes.
And even Gerard was talking about, oh, you know what, why do you always have to have all the girls? You're just going to hurt her afterwards. Like, come on, dude. You're hurt. You ain't thinking about her. You try to score the whole time, and your boy just comes in and gets a breakaway and just scores just like that. That touches a little bit. I don't care who you are. That's pushing a little bit.
I mean, I look at it like this. I mean, yeah, I believe he broke guy code. You know, once the Thanksgiving dinner was over, should he have probably just let her go home and maybe do the dishes on his own or whatever? If he should have did that, yeah, maybe. You know, maybe make a call the next day to say, like, yo, I'm kind of interested in, you know, in Angela. But at the same time, I mean, Gerard is, like, the definition of the friend zone. Like, he may as well have that, like, tattooed on his face, like Mike Tyson, just around his eye. I mean, somebody like Angela, I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, of course, because I do believe he broke high code. But I'm like, you kind of knew he wasn't going to. He tried to shoot the shot. You knew he wasn't going to make it.
Yeah, but that's not the point, though. The point is, you know, let me start over. It's true, like, the whole thing, like, how they set it up where, like, you know what, he asked, like, at first he told her, like, go home, and then he saw how much dishes he had to do, and he's like, oh, after a second about, can't you help me? And then, you know, they fell asleep and all that. So it definitely, they played the angle really well, that it wasn't like he was trying.
He was on a hunt. Like, he wasn't on a hunt to get it.
He wasn't on a hunt for it. You know what I mean? But still, at the end of the day, you don't just trip and fall in the pussy at the same time, right?
Right.
As they're kissing, they're both saying, like, what are we doing here kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So back of your head, you know that you're not supposed to do this. But then start thinking from the other head, and you're like, you know what? Let me get in. Even though you know Gerard is not going to get in, the fact that you know he's into her and he's trying in the whole nine, you got to pump the brakes to at least be like, yo, you know what? Let's have a conversation first,
yeah,
and not after the fact. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
you could wait. You could wait a night.
Exactly. At the very least,
it's not that. It's not that urgent. It's totally played that wrong, and they really glanced over it. And in the end, there's no way that, you know, David Unger's character didn't have some animosity towards him.
In real life, come on. I mean, this is a movie, so they got to finish it in 90 minutes. It ain't gonna be that easy.
No,
you know what I mean?
In real life, these guys are never really the same. They're never that close again.
It's funny in real life when he opens up the door and he sees him for the first time, it's a punch to the face. And
yeah,
you ain't just walking in. You're walking out.
Right.
You're like, I'm not participating in this.
And yeah, you're like, man, I ain't dealing with this here.
Let's be real with this. Calvin, we had a situation similar to this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Remember who was
Well, we won't name names, but yeah.
No, let's name, I mean, you can bleep it out afterwards, but let's name the track girl, the tall one. What's her name again?
Yeah.
Did you say what's the smut's name?
Yeah, What was the name again?
I ain't gonna name the name, but go on. Yeah, we know who it is. Go on.
Okay. So, anyway, Mama doesn't know the situation. Regardless.
No, it's okay. You can tell the story. Tell the story for them.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm going to tell the story. Yeah. I met this girl at a track meet in Windsor. She was from Windsor. Met her at a track meet. Well, actually, I think I met her at a track meet and then on sport, and she's from Windsor. Yeah, I think that's what it means. I met her at a track meet in Toronto, and she's from Windsor. You know what I mean? She's, you know, cute. You know, we exchanged, you know, flirting, nothing, you know, nothing came of it. Then I think I met her at Sports Weekend again in Windsor back in the day. Exchanged numbers.
Oh, yeah.
Da, da, da. Sports Weekend. yeah, remember back in the day, Sports Weekend and all that stuff?
Yeah.
And, yeah, man.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? It was one of those things, differently than with Gerard. It wasn't like I wasn't falling for her. I mean, she was there, but nothing really transpired. I ended up going to school in Chicago, and then she ended up moving to Toronto. And then I was like, oh, you know what? It's used to my boy Calvin. You know, he knows the city. He's been here, da-da-da-da. So then I move out now. These two are still cool. But at the same time, Calvin knew the first time I met, I was like, yo, I met this nice little, you know, little chick at a track meet, da-da-da-da. So would I sweat with her if it went that way? Of course. I mean, but was I sweating in any means? Absolutely not. But at the same time, Calvin didn't know that. So Calvin made sure when they started, like, feeling each other, he called me up. And I'm in a different country now. I'm not even thinking about it no more. But bro code, he calls me up and be like, yo, hey, what was the deal with you and Smut? And I was like, ain't nothing really there. Go through and do your thing. And the reason I call her that now is because Calvin knows why. She was good then, but she turned that way afterwards. So there's reasons for that. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not defending the name calling.
But. Yeah. But at the same time, because he didn't know what the situation was or how it was left, as a bro, before anything happened, even though I was in a different country, he's calling me up and be like, yo, what's the deal? And I'm like, all right, you know what? Peace, go for it. That's bro code.
That's bro code. And you know what?
That's bro code. And
you know what's great about that conversation? I don't even think you let me even finish asking. And you were like, yo. You're like, just the fact that you called me was like, yo, that's enough. I don't even, you're like, do whatever you want to do. I'm good.
Yo, Calvin knows, back in the day, I was like, yo, just tell me the story. Just give me the story.
I've literally
told afterwards, and I'm good.
I've literally heard Teddy say that too. just tell me the story.
Tell me the story and commissions. That was all I cared about.
That was the.
You go to party with Headley. You find some chick. Who's she with? Where are her friends? Who'd she come here with?
Yeah.
Where's my commission on this?
Yo, there's even been times I've gone to a party, started talking to girls, she's like, you know what I mean? Nothing's really there. I was like, listen, those are my boys all there. I got tall, I got short, I got light, I got dark, I got fat, I got slim. Who do you like? Because I was like, I just want to know the story. I just want to hear I want to get something out of this.
So basically, the statute of limitations is gone on this now in terms of the term commission. So, you know, we can share it here, I guess, at this point.
Let's let the truth come out now, Calvin.
No, it's not.
I'm lying.
No, it's not bad.
Calvin's like, all right, I can tell you now. I had already slept with her by the time I asked you.
Well, first of all, stop letting Mambo cook your head, Edley. My God, you're jumping to conclusions already. I ain't trying to air out your stuff. Don't worry, man. I'm just trying to explain to people what commissions is. So basically what that was basically whoever you got with, you basically had to make sure she had a friend so that you can get her to hook up with your boy or one of your boys. So that was the thing, especially me and you living in Toronto, you know, when me and you were basically in the dating game. I don't want to say running wild, but in the dating game, to be nice. And that was the thing. So anytime Headley bagged the woman, I'm like, yo, she got a friend? Yeah, she looked kind of good. All right, hook it up. And that's the commission story. Don't worry, I ain't gonna air out your business. But yeah, but that, I mean, those were good times though. But
yeah, those were good times.
Yeah, and that's the thing. To me, you know, going back to the bro code and the guy code thing is just. At the end of the day, I'm like, especially if it's somebody that I grew up with and, you know, we had such a long history. I'm like, man, I'm like, I don't want to make that complicated because of some, you know, some woman. You know what I mean? It's better I just make a quick phone call. And it's funny, as what you said before, Mambo, it's kind of like, yo, I could wait a night. You know what I mean? I could wait a day or two. You know what I mean? Let me just clear the air first and then go through. There's two things that ruin guy relationships. Is money and is women. So to me, I'm like, you know what? Let me not fall to one of these two. Let me just at least clear the air in that situation. And I think that's what Marcus should have done.
But as we're saying, there's so many, the way expression comes, there's so many fish in the sea. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Like, unless you're going to cross me, if you're going to cross me dearly, let this be your soulmate and you end up having a couple kids with it and you go down, like, you know what I mean? Where it is now at a bigger power than me, where you have to cross that path. Make sure it's worth it. But if you're going to do that just to get some ass at the end of the day, like, as you know, like, I've had a friend that we were tight for like 10 years. And he did some things that was faulty. it started with something like that, and then it kind of opened my eyes to, like, okay, what's the type of person he is? And we never, our relationship never been the same after that. Actually, our relationship, we didn't have a relationship after that. You know, I mean, to the point now, like, if we see each other, I mean, I'll say what up, but friendship was done. And you have to think at the end of the day, like, yo, was it really worth it at the end of the day to go kind of snake-like when in actuality, like, for what? There was nothing special about that person. But when you do something like that, it opens up to the type of person that you are and be like, ah, you know what? I don't need that in my circle.
So we're all in agreement. Eddie Murphy was wrong.
Yep.
Yeah, and as you said, it was a... You wish it would have ended on a more realistic basis. If it was the real way of ending, it would have ended off with just them being together and Gerard, you know, in a bar drinking somewhere.
And the thing about it, what makes it be, like, I don't know if it's better or worse if they would have hooked up and then mashed up, but now the fact that they hooked up and now it seems like they're in this great relationship now, and now, like, If there was a part two of Boomerang, like, how is it when Gerard sees these people all the time? How awkward is that? That, you know, when that you were trying, now you see your boy all up in her ear and giggling, and I don't know.
Yeah, part two, he's definitely going off kilter.
Gerard tries to get with Robin Gibbons. Gerard tries to get with Jacqueline.
Yeah,
I'm gonna get back at Eddie. Yeah.
He comes back at Thanksgiving with Jacqueline, like, yo, like, what up? What? I ain't a friend now, huh? The funny part is I'm looking at this conversation, I'm listening to this conversation, and I'm like, I know there's about half, there's some dudes out there like, so what's the problem? What's the problem with what he did? So what's the big deal?
and you know what? And those are
the guys that you want to do nothing with her.
Yeah, but, you know, as you said, teach your own, right? That's mm-hmm. the type of people I wouldn't want. I wouldn't call them my people then. Because me and Calvin even joked that there's some people that I would call them an acquaintance, and literally sometimes I'd be like, damn, that's his woman? And I'd be like, I won't name no names, but like, every time I see her, I'd be like, man, I wonder if she's still with so-and-so. It's like you know when you kind of like, check the pulse if somebody's still alive, and you put your, you know, you put your hand underneath their nose to see if they're still breathing. Like, that would be me with some people. Like, yo, as soon as this is over, before it's fresh, I'm in it. But then at the end of the day, that person I wouldn't call a friend. You know what I mean? We're acquaintances. Yeah. We're not. I wouldn't call them. You know, it's not like our numbers are programming each other's phones kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. I see them, but like, we're good, but. You know what I mean? But if you call somebody a friend and you can do that, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if you're really much of a friend then.
I think that's the rule of thumb. Once you break bread with somebody, whether it's a trip together, just anything, any situation where you're breaking bread, conversations, I don't know what the barometer is, but that's my rule of thumb. Once you break bread with somebody, whatever that is, that concept for you, the definition that it is for you for breaking bread, Once you accomplish that with somebody, yeah, you gotta, especially when it comes to like just guy friends, you gotta just you gotta pick mm-hmm. up that phone or send a text or something.
Yeah.
That's yeah. just at least yeah. to me. You know what I mean? At least to me. You know. Like I said, I know everybody plays with, you know, with different rules and everything else, but with my set of friends that I came up with and the people that I met later on, and especially in Toronto and stuff, that was always kind of like our rule of thumb. Cause I remember I had a friend of mine who was like, man, he's like, one of my exes is interested in him, and I'm like, if you want to go ahead, you know, I'm like, I don't think about my ex, and it ain't gonna bother me, you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm practically married at this point, so you know. But the fact that same thing that you know, at least you gave me a quick shout just to check. I mean, yo, that's cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to add to that, Mambo? Before I move on to the next question.
Now let's go. Next question.
Okay.
Yes, I agree.
Wait, let me ask Bobo something. So you're trying to say if I was single, Angela would be game?
What? Next question. Wait, can we not move on from this? All right, I'll put out the next question. like Grace Jones. Like at that time,
right?
Did Grace Jones, like the fact that Grace Jones is in this film and her character, did that really hit home for you guys? Because like I know you guys are the same age as me, and we're like young, and she was like before our generation. What do you kind of think of that, like now versus now, and looking back at Grace Jones being involved in this project?
For me, back then, is complete two completely different thought process. Because back then, I just thought she was scary. I was like, man, what is appealing about this chick? I don't want nothing to do with her. Now looking at it, to be honest, and I asked this question earlier, who was your favorite small role character? She was for me in this movie. I thought she was spectacular in this movie. You know, just the way she just didn't give a shit. You know, the fact that she took her drawers off and rubbed it in the doctor's face when she didn't think the perfume was smelling right, you know, like, and just propositioning Marcus in the movie, and you know, you don't want this, you don't want this, like just that whole, like, yo, she killed that. She killed that.
She did.
She really killed that.
She commanded that scene.
Yeah, but back then, yeah, I wouldn't say scared, but I was like, it was a little off-putting to me, you know, back then when I was younger. But like now, she's like my favorite character one of my favorite characters in the movie, for sure.
That's a good point. I think at that time, I didn't really realize just how iconic she was. I mean, whatever. We're like early, young, you know, early teens or whatever. You didn't really realize just how iconic of an actress, a star she was, musician, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Kedley, if that connected with you at all.
Not really. Not when I was young, because I was like, you know, as Calvin said, I just didn't think, I thought this career, she was nuts. She played the part well. Yeah, you know, in retrospect, you'd be like, oh, this. She basically has quite a bit of a breadth to her work and to the roles that she can play, just knowing the kind of actress that she is, or she still is, so to speak. But back then, be like, yeah, I just thought she was just playing a lunatic. I really didn't know who Grace Jones was then. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Perfect for that role, and then that role like encompassing who she was, like this kind of groundbreaking, stereotype breaking, iconic star.
Yeah,
in the movie and out of the movie too, right? Because in the movie she's this big time model and, you know, world class model and everything else, and then obviously off camera, you know, she's this legend, right? Like she's just, she's one of the great personalities of just period that you'd ever run across, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
but has she ever played a role like that before?
Like when we were younger, I remember Grace Jones best for like her role in like the James Bond movie. Which is that? It was one of the Roger Moore James Bond movies. Mm-hmm. I don't remember which one.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I remember her best for, and it was, you know, kind of same. I mean, she was in one of the Conan movies too, right?
Yeah.
Remember she played. I remember her and James Earl Jones in one of the Conan movies. But that was, you know, I wasn't up on her full filmography back then.
Right. Yeah, I'll be lying if I say that I did. But I mean, musically, she had some tracks that were pretty nice, especially some house stuff that was actually pretty good. It's like she's become, like, as time went along, she's now become one of my favorite characters in the movie, outside of, I would say, Eddie Murphy, of course, and Martin, you know, who played Tyler in the movie. I thought those are my two favorite characters, but I think she's right there. Oh, and Tisha Campbell, too. Tisha Campbell was hilarious. But
so, you know what's crazy? Is when you look back at now, the budget for the movie was like $45 million.
Really? Was that high back then?
That's what I was saying. When I looked at it, I was like, you know what?
Well, I mean, how much of that was Eddie alone?
You have your computer right there in front of you. Go check it out real quick. I think it was like, yeah, it was in that $40 to $50 million range. And like, I was like, whoa, man, that's a high budget for one thing. It's not like the blown up stuff. So it's not like there's a lot of action where there's a lot of cost in the budget to that. So you're really talking about, I don't know, just paying the actors and I don't know how much Eddie was pulling in at that, but I was like, yo, that's a big risk, big stake movie, especially for the role that Eddie was playing, because this wasn't a typical Eddie Murphy type movie. Mm-hmm. And as Calvin was talking about, I didn't really see Eddie as a, like, really in a downfall or in a slump, but his movies wasn't, the last few movies wasn't huge box office hits, right? So I don't know if he fronted the movie part of it himself, because I know he was an executive producer on it, but I thought that was a high budget, and
They I think they quadrupled or tripled their revenue on it. So I mean, obviously they made money.
42.
It's 42, right? Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Something like that. He was in the 40-50 range. And
it was his production company.
Yeah, it was.
Eddie Murphy Productions.
Yeah.
Because it was his story. He wrote it. He wrote the movie. I mean, he didn't maybe write the screen, but I remember that he was like the writer of it, or it was his concept.
Well, it was his vision, and then he brought in somebody to write it. I guess that's probably pretty common anyways, to get somebody to adapt it to like a screenplay, so to speak.
Can you write me a movie where I have Robin Givens half naked in lingerie in my bed with me? Can somebody work on that script for me, please?
You know?
I don't have much of a vision, to be honest. Like, I want to be in bed with Robin Givens. It's exceptional that, like, that here's a film, you know, that's done in 1992, comes out in 1992, and it has a budget of $42 million with an all-black cast. I mean, that, like, is phenomenal. And not only that, but it actually does well. I mean, it made, you know, over $100 million in the box office. It was a successful film.
But you have to say, not only is it a big budget for all black film, but as we talked about at the very beginning, it was a storyline which wasn't typical. Affluent black successful business men and women.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna put a budget of that high, it isn't gonna be you're gonna go on the safe lane. This wasn't safe at all, and it, as you said, blew expectations by, you know, by quadrupling and tripling its money.
And when you look at it, it got panned critically. Like, it got bad reviews.
It did.
People were like completely shitting on this film when it came out. And it still was successful. I mean, because like you realize that this was a film that, you know, it didn't still the stereotypes of what, you know, the average American film going audience was expecting from a black film, especially an all black cast, right?
Right.
And so I think a lot of people just were like, this doesn't make sense. There's no this fictional company, right? Lady Eloise, this fictional company with all black people in it, some sort of like middle class black working paradise of some sort, or upper class really. It did not really connect with a lot of the American film-going audience, but it was still a successful film, like in the box office. Just critically, it got panned, which is interesting.
I think it really is. Do you think some of the other critics are kind of like, so wait a minute, so Doughboy's not going to pop out in the scene? Where's the Jerry Curl guys? Where's the guns?
Where's the clown face?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, right? That's what people are kind of expecting. Is it's like, wait, no, this is not the way that black people live. This is not the way black people, you know, act. I don't understand what's happening here.
Right. like when Marcus broke guy code, they're like, okay, Gerard's pulling out the gun now, right? Right? Wait. He just walks out of the bar.
Where's the fighting? It was a very odd lack of fighting. Nobody.
When you went up on that rooftop, they're like, "Oh, finally, a Juice episode is going to pop off." and they started hugging like "Kumbaya," like "Ah!"
You know, they expected a big fight scene at the end. Marcus still yells out, "Bishop!"
We know. We all know if that happened, though, Gerard would have let him go one time. Wouldn't even have tried. Wouldn't have even tried.
All right, so let me ask a couple other questions here before I wrap up. What was your favorite scene in the movie? Hedley, I'll start with you.
Oh, man.
I know, it's a hard question. I know. Because there's so many,
honestly. Was there a scene with Robin Givens? No, I'm just playing. When she comes in, which scene where she's like half naked? One of those scenes. Is that it?
Yeah. Honestly, man.
I can say I can say for sure. I mean, I know I said this earlier, right? Like the scene with John Witherspoon comes in, the dad, that entire scene at that dinner absolutely kills me, and he steals the scene. It was absolutely great. That's probably my favorite scene in the entire film. The one that like I remember the most is pretty iconic.
Yeah.
Hilarious, funny scene. I also oddly one scene that like I always kind of found amusing, but it's like really short, is You know when they're redoing the commercial with Halle Berry and Marcus? They're reshooting the commercial, and they have that scene where they're like, "Is that a nipple?" And they're like, "No, it's not a nipple." and then you realize it's like they have the editor there who's doing the editing, and it's freaking it's Melvin Van Peebles, and he's like, "No, that's a shadow of a nipple," and then you hear him, "No, zoom in." Zooms in and he's like, "No, that's definitely a nipple. I know because I'm drooling." And like for some reason that scene just like cracks me up every time. And the fact that like here's this film that like completely this big ensemble black cast iconic film now looking back at it especially, and they knew at that time they're like, we have to figure a way to get Melvin Van Peebles in this film because of who he is. Who he like represents in terms of like the black filmmaking genre. Like he is an iconic flying in the face of what white society's expectations in the US are in terms of like what a black person on the screen should act like, what they should sound like. And I love that he's in that. And like, even though it's this really short, small scene, I absolutely think it was just the best thing to have him in that one moment.
So, as you guys already know, the scene that always makes me laugh is can we make this darker? For some reason, I'll never forget that line, and even though, as I said from before, I know it's coming, I can't help but laugh every single time when I see that scene. On a more, I guess, serious note. The scene with him and Halle Berry where, you know, he comes back and is like, you know what, things happen with him and his boss, and he's like, you know what, you can't help with love. And then when she gives him that finger point right in his forehead, it was like, love should have brought you back home. I was like, yo, that part was kind of like, okay, that looked real. Like, you could see people going through this exact same scenario 100 times over. Your boys, it could have been yourselves, you could have been on either side of that situation, and you feel like you're listening to a secret of many homes and many relationships where that exact same scene has happened. And I was like, yo, they nailed how that kind of played out.
Mm-hmm. Had Holly cussing and everything.
Yeah, man, exactly. For real.
She dug deep. She's remembering something. That moment.
Yeah, I mean,
remembering something.
Probably remembering. Not too long ago, too. I mean, she has a whole lot of examples she can pull from. And you know, and quietly, you know, that song where I can't remember the name of it. The song that was played when he sees the Epiphany sign or advertisement on the bus.
PM Dawn. Yeah. Die Without You.
Oh, that song is straight, yo.
But yeah, but it's funny as you said that when she pokes his head, Marcus's head in the movie, when you mentioned that part, that line, "Love Should Have Brought You Home Last Night," you guys don't realize that was probably one of the biggest songs of that year from Toni Braxton, and it came from this movie, right from the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. "Love Should Have Brought You Home." Mm-hmm. That's one of her biggest songs before she came out with her own album, right?
For real?
Yeah. Okay. But it's a great, you know, it's a classic song, but. And that speaks to not just the movie, but I mean, I know we don't have enough time to really get into this, but like even the soundtrack too, because I mean, something like that sparks one of the classic songs in the soundtrack. And the soundtrack is, for the listeners who don't know, I mean, that's, again, it's one of the best-selling soundtracks in music history. I think it sold like 3-4 million records. And put it this way, you had Tribe Called Quest, Hot Sex on the Platter. You know that song? That song. That song is probably one of the least popular songs on that album. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, it was a more R&B album, but, I mean, that's to tell you just the star power from Toni Braxton, Kenny, Babyface Edmonds, and Keith Sweat, and Aaron Hall. Everybody had, like, TLC. There was so much star power on that soundtrack, too. You know, so it kind of matched up with the movie, which is great. I mean, there's so many scenes. The dinner scene, as you mentioned, Mambo, obviously, that's a classic. Just this... John Witherspoon said so many just hot lines in that scene alone that just stands to the test of time.
Yeah.
The suit scene when they're trying to get fitted for suits, or they're looking at different suits, and the store clerk comes in and says, "Hey, you know, we don't have a layaway plan here. You know, we don't keep cash in the store." Like that.
Oh, yeah.
That scene is a classic scene too. One of my favorite scenes too, honestly, is when Marcus goes to basically shoot a shot with Jacqueline, like at the ball, when he's basically like, "Yo, I'm giving you my vibe, my Mac Daddy vibe. Like, yo, what's good?" You know, trying to shoot a shot with Jacqueline. And the reason why I kind of like that scene, just because, again, as a dude, just harkening back to the single days, as you guys know, there was few feelings back in the day that was better than the chase. You know what I mean? So that, especially when the chemistry is out there. So that scene is, I always like that scene, because it was like, you know, he's shooting this shot and it's like, yo, what are you going to do about it? You going to block it? Let me go to the hoop. Like, what are you going to do? And then you just go from there. But that's like one of my favorite scenes. Underratedly, one of my favorite scenes in that movie.
Yeah, it's pretty straight too.
It's cool.
And then of course the an underrated one too. Obviously, the any scene honestly as well with Tisha Campbell in it. You can't forget her in that movie. Just her bit part as a neighbor in that movie, just trying to shit all over Marcus's plans every time he brings a woman in the house. That was hilarious. That was hilarious.
Yo, I was like, man, Marcus, how you gonna go shit that close to home?
That's way too close.
I'm saying, you know, like, dude, that should be in your rule book. Like, you can't do that.
You literally should wait.
Somebody's bedroom window from home. You should not be messing with that.
This guy had a heckler who lived next to his house. Like, your next door neighbor is just your heckler.
Yeah, for real.
I forgot to mention about like that scene with Layla Rashan where he's like, he hooks up with her, and then they're both sleeping. She's sleeping, and he pulls the sheets over to show her hammer toes. Mm-hmm. I remember at that point being like, I remember being young and being like, really? Is that like a deal breaker? Is that like, she's super hot? Like, what? I was like a teenager. You're like,
toes all of a sudden now.
What?
And now you secretly start looking at people's toes now.
I know, it's true, right? You started checking feet after that.
It woke you up to like a new, like, you're like, that's a thing I gotta look out for. Like, what? Yeah, I never even thought of that.
Yo, so much classic lines. Bang, 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 gold star for Marcus. That one you're talking about too was, you know, I can't believe a girl so beautiful, has hammer time in her shoe, but then Martin's like, you don't f*** your feet. there's just so much classic lines in that movie, man. I can't believe it's that old.
Pretty much every single line by Chris Rock was a classic. Yeah, of him too. Being like, so, you know, I've been here for about a week now, and I'm looking at like moving up and promotions, and we could talk about that. Like, I've been here a week now, and I've mostly been coming in on time. And what if I talk to you now about promotions? Like, man, so many good ones. It's a funny movie. It's a hilarious movie, man. I mean, we could go on forever about it.
Yeah, no doubt. So my last question is this. What's your lasting impression on this movie? I'll start with you, Mambo, to wrap it up.
I mean, my lasting impression is just, you know, looking back on it and you know, watching it again recently for this, you know, so we could have this conversation. I think it's just the realization of how iconic and positive messaging. I mean, all right, I'm going to have to actually like put aside the womanizing, the sexism. I'm talking about like that, but that idea that like positive thing of an all black cast working in like just having this film where they're working in this like all black space, this company, a bunch of successful black people. I think for me, like that's an interesting, iconic image that would like be more normal to see that in a film nowadays, especially like, you know, there was a whole resurgence of like black cinema in the late 90s, early 2000s. But at that time, this was really, it was groundbreaking to do something like that. It was very different. And I think that is part of the reason why it was actually not critically received very well.
I was going to say the same thing in respect. You know, watching a movie again 25 years later, like it still resonated with me.
Right.
So it wasn't like, it didn't feel like I was watching something that was dated. Another point, which Mambo already touched on, just, you know, as you said, it's a comedy, right? So obviously, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's where the comedy's coming from is the whole womanizing, right? And then kind of like switching the spots that they did that creativity very well. But in retrospect, as we talked about at the beginning, just seeing in a positive roles as not just being law-abiding citizens, but like affluent, successful, ultra-successful professionals in their space, which in this case was being advertising executives. That's the last impression that it should have on anybody. The whole womanizing, I mean, that's all the comedy, right? But it's what the canvas behind the painting, which was the makeup of it, which was great. As you said, it's not something that you saw typically then. It's probably, this was obviously before Best Man and all these other, you know, Tyler Perry movies where you had everybody, you know, that was in affluent, successful positions. This was well before that time. And what's funny, outside of the Cosby Show that we already talked about, which was on a small screen, do you guys even recall anything really before or after that in years past it? And obviously, you know, this is right on the whim. We probably have to sit down and be like, there probably was something close in around that time frame. But just on the top of my head, I can't really think of any other movie that had that kind of background in story and background or canvas to the story, which was them being in this space in New York, which was cool.
I agree.
I'm trying to think.
No, I can't think of any. But it's funny. I agree with you. You actually stole one of my points. But I agree with you that I think this movie kind of sparked some of the positive images we got to see later in the decade, and you know, and further on afterwards. From like, and that was one of the movies I was going to mention, The Best Man, as well as even like Love Jones, because Love Jones, they were a little younger, but you know, it's not a violent movie. It's just a progressive movie about young 20-something-year-old black people trying to do their thing in life, and trying to figure out love and just life and everything else that goes along with that. So that's one of the trademarks this movie kind of left in the way, just in terms of just positive images. That is just more than just. And as much as I love like Boys in the Hood and Juice and those type of movies and Menace to Society and all that, like it's nice to see those other images on the big screen. You know what I mean? Like we did see some of that in the small screen with The Cosby Show and one of the most underrated shows ever, A Different World. But you know, you don't see that every day. I mean, you still don't see it too often now. I mean, you see it more than you did before, but I mean, you can still see more of it, obviously.
I think like now you see it a lot more with like
the Kevin Harts and different things. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Even
Love Jones is like, I mean, when you think about it, Love Jones is 96 though. Like Love Jones came later.
Yeah.
Love Jones came years later. I mean, at that time it was still like, what's probably the best portrayal we're looking at then is like what, Poetic Justice or something like that? It's like at least he had a job. He was a mailman, wasn't he? Or something like that.
I mean, you weren't ultra. It wasn't ultra successful. I mean, there's Law of Dying, but not ultra successful like in this one, right?
Right.
But, you know, just thinking about Love Jones, when you mentioned Love Jones, that Love Jones soundtrack, and not to take away, but from Boomerang. Oof.
That's one of the greatest.
That was a hot soundtrack.
All I'll say is this. That was my go-to CD. That was my go-to CD. I honestly, if I got past track five, something was wrong. Something was wrong. Something went horribly wrong if I went past track five.
Yeah, honestly, Love Jones, Jodeci, and the Brown Sugar CD. Yeah, man. They helped me out.
That's right. Hedley had a deep, deep flashback. Like, just the way you said that. Yeah, that took me back.
I was like, yeah.
You felt the shiver in his bones when he said that.
Yeah, dude, he came back.
Somebody's about to wake up the wife after this podcast. but I agree with you guys. My lasting image is of that. Honestly, just a positive image of successful black people. And for me, it's like. It is what happens in life. You know what I mean? Like we do see that. I mean, for instance, I have some like great friends who are like family to me, and as well as you, Hedley, you lived in DC for a little while, and you know, going to DC, that was like an example of that. For example, because you know, you go to like happy hour and different things like that. you always saw like young progressive black people doing their thing, whether it was like, you know, you meet somebody at the bar, they're like a lawyer, you know, they're going through law school, they're, you know, somebody's doing their master's, somebody's, you know, trying to get into to the political field, somebody's doing this, you know what I mean? Like, you just saw just people doing their thing, you know what I mean? And it was all positive, you know, for a large part of it, like, at least the times I used to go to DC and go visit and hang out for, you know, like periods of time and stuff. So it's like looking back at that movie, it's like, yeah, you know, you kind of did see those things. It is out there. You know what I mean? They had to get the idea from somewhere. That, you know, I don't think they just pulled it out of the sky, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody would doubt that it was a reality of life, and like, especially in like large metropolitan cities with like large black populations like D.C., Atlanta.
Right.
But to see it on the screen, there was no filmmakers, no like film financiers that were willing to really back a film that had that. So that's why it was, you know... Yeah,
especially at that budget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the shocker of it of this whole thing is just, I didn't realize the budget was that large even back then. That's a big budget even for back
$42 million back then. If you put that like interest, man, imagine what that is now.
Oh, I know.
And the thing is like they were blowing up buildings. It was a comedy. You know what I mean?
Eddie,
unless they're eating
that money out, man.
That's what I'm saying. Unless they're eating caviar every day, you know, Eddie made some ransom money.
Yeah, Eddie was like $25 million.
You know what I mean? For real.
Ate that whole budget, bro.
I know. They couldn't even make this movie now because Martin would want $25 million, Holly Berry would want $30 million. You know, everybody would want big money out of that movie. Even Chris Rock would be like, no, I ain't even taking that role. I want Gerard's role. Like,
you need to get like Lance Gross and all these, you know what I mean? You couldn't get.
Yeah, Laz Alonso and guys like that. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, exactly.
Even Idris Elba would want like at least $20 million before he gets off the couch to do something like this.
He's out this market now.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Yep.
Anyways, fellas, thank you for coming on this podcast, this Boomerang edition of the podcast, talking about the classic movie.
No doubt. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
And yes, and before we go, Mambo, plug your You got something to plug. You got your 30 for 30 podcast you've been working on for a while. Let the people know about it.
The series is out, so it came out with the first episode that was the Trials of Dan and Dave about Dan O'Brien and Dave Johnson and their Dan and Dave campaign in 1992. So everybody should go and check that out. You can listen to it. It's up already. It's on iTunes, wherever you get podcasts, on ESPN app, and it's available on the web. And we have episodes coming out every Tuesday. And I have an episode that's coming out on July 25th, which is the last one of this season, about a boxer. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give too much away of the story because I think there's a bit of a reveal in there, but it's something that I think a lot of people will like. It's a pretty compelling story, and everybody should check it out.
What's your edition of the one that you produce? What is it called? Just to give
called
out the
Fighter
name.
It's called The Fighter Inside, and that's the 30 for 30 podcast. I didn't even mention that part, but yeah, ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast is out right now. iTunes, Stitcher, whatever apps anybody uses. I know that like everybody on Android's got a million and one different apps. So wherever you listen to podcasts, and if you don't listen to podcasts, you should start by listening to the 30 for 30 podcast. And definitely be ready for it. July 25th, The Fighter Inside. I think everybody's going to like it. It's a good story.
Yeah, man, no doubt. Everybody listen to that because, listen, this brother here put a lot of work into it. And this is the last thing I'm probably going to promote, you know, unless he comes back on another podcast before August 15th. So, you know, this is something definitely people should listen to 100%.
That's part of the reason I was like, we got to get this in before fantasy football season starts. Look, yeah, Calvin will never talk about it.
That embargo will be cut off. They'll be like, yo, you want to mention my show? No, fuck your show.
No, who's leading the head-to-head between you two?
Oh, I got him.
I am by far. I don't even know if Calvin's ever won anything between us.
I got him. Plus, I got a championship to prove it. Do you have one?
No.
Anyways, thank you once again, fellas, for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Cut you off.
Yeah.
Thank you all for tuning in to the Boomerang edition of the AV Podcast. Special shout outs go out to Headley and Andrew Mombo for coming out and sharing their thoughts on the classic movie. And once again, make sure you tune in to the 30 for 30 podcast series on ESPN, which Mombo is a producer of. Make sure you tune into that as well on the ESPN app, on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, make sure you look out for the premiere of Season 2 of The Stoop, which will be out within the next week or two. And as usual, to subscribe to the podcast shows, make sure you subscribe right here to SouthShoreAV.com. Once again, that's SouthShoreAV.com. For Andrew Mombo and Headley, this is Cal C. And this is the AV Podcast on South Shore AV Radio. Until the next pod, folks. Peace. We out.